This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasolines. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now with your host, Rick Moore.
Oh, that's me, and happy Easter to all those who celebrate the Christian faith, and happy Sunday to all those who do not, as long as you're having a nice day. Although, you know what, we took the dog out for a walk this morning, or the dogs, oh so humid. Supposed to be something like upper 80s today. We'll get to the weather about 20 after. 90 tomorrow. What in the world happened to spring? Regardless, we have a pretty interesting show lined up for the hour today. Our guest today, Professor Gerard Alexander. How are you, sir?
Good morning. I'm a little muggy, I'll be honest.
Well, it is a little muggy out there in the world. And then you were rushing around to get here. Everyone has their life outside of the radio station, and hopefully yours allows you to be here for the whole hour, because just telling people what we were going to talk about today and the op-eds, opinion columns that you had written for the Washington Post immediately had people like raising their shoulders from one side of the fence or the other. The goal today is to talk about at least what I want to try and fit into the hour is, are bipartisan politics even possible? I'm not sure that that really fits in our world anymore. And Professor Alexander, the two columns that you wrote in 2010, if I remember correctly, one was done in February and one was in October.
Sounds right.
Why are liberals so condescending? Conservatism does not equal racism.
In my defense, the editor of the Outlook section of the Post picked those two titles. And as all op-ed writers know, we don't get to select that. And he like other editors and TV producers, liked a more pugilistic tone so that readers would react, which they did.
Well, and from what I can tell, readers did react. I think in doing my homework, aside from just reading the columns, I attempted to do a little bit of the comments that were made. And on one of the sites that I found, it was listed as, I believe, the February column, which, if I remember correctly, was "Why Are Liberals So Condescending?" had more comments fed about the article than any other op-ed article written in the Washington Post since such knowledge and numbers had started being kept.
The Outlook editor told me sometime afterwards that in his time at that section, that article had more hits, not comments, but just hits by readers, than any other column by several orders. By several times. And we know that, if anything, that underestimated its distribution, because often the entire article was cut and pasted into emails, and those were circulated on email chains. I remember at one point getting an email from a former student of mine who'd received it from her grandmother, who'd gotten it from her church group, and all of that done without any clicks, because it was the entire article being forwarded, not the link. And I got 1,000 emails to me personally, and it was incredibly vitriolic. I mean, in many ways, my column was pugilistic, I grant, and the comments I got back were either of the "you tell 'em, rock 'em, sock 'em" variety, or the "I hate you, die in hell" variety. And I suppose they just make your point that this doesn't seem to be a very friendly national conversation.
But we'll do our best for the hour. Again, our guest today, Professor Gerard Alexander from University of Virginia's Department of Politics. We will be speaking about his two recent columns from 2010 in the Washington Post, "Conservatism Does Not Equal Racism," and then another one, "Why Are Liberals So Condescending?" Let me take a moment and thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for allowing us to be on the air today. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports, where you are encouraged to be kind, have fun, and do the right thing. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports is at Barrack Show Shopping Center in Charlottesville, and at 3 locations in Richmond. For more store information, find them online. It's brms.com. I also need to give a shout out to those listening on 101.1, the new number over at Crozet and in the Valley. All right, so let's just jump right into the topic. You tell us how the titles came about. You did not select the titles, but you wrote the material, which, while I may not be able to find those sentences in there where the editor sort of like, I believe what you said was cut and paste, the editor couldn't cut and paste those five or six words and put them on the headline. You wrote, I can say that it sure as heck sounded like that it was in the text, and I printed it out, and it's like four pages or five pages of Times New Roman font size 12, etc. So it was a good amount of material. What makes you say this? It will eventually, at some point, shortly, we'll jump into one versus the other, or do one for a time and come back to the other. But it sure sounds like it's a one side, from one side of the fence. If I had to guess, you're a strong conservative political science professor who has your hopes, dreams, wishes, and beliefs already set in stone, and this is what you're standing up and wagging your finger at.
I'm next to an old hound dog, so I'm going to say wagging my tail. It's more sounds more
that's
friendly.
Your Lazarus is in the studio with you.
Yes, I when I joked that the editor had chosen that title, he also actually helped, like with all good editors, helped with some of the text and some of the more pugilistic, less academically worded sentences. I think were inspired more by editorial instincts than my instincts. But all I'm not trying to get away from my fundamental argument, and I'll tell you where that the article about liberals' condescension was born was. In my readings about debates between conservatives and liberals or conservatives and progressives, whatever phrasing we want to use, in the 1950s, 60s, 70s and onwards, in which it struck me that one thing that often happened in debates was that liberals often accused conservatives in debates over poverty policy, for example, of not caring about the poor. And I just noted and what I think is an asymmetry in our national discourse over the last few decades. And the handy example I use is that when liberals want to raise the minimum wage, a lot of conservatives and free market economists and others will say, look, the risk of doing that is by raising the price that employers must pay workers, you run the risk that less skilled workers, particularly young ones, are going to end up being priced out of the market. Employers will look at someone who may not be worth $7.25 an hour and say, look, I'm sorry, I'm just not going to employ you at all. I would have at $5.25. And free market economists from Milton Friedman on down have been warning for decades that with higher minimum wage rates go higher youth unemployment rates, particularly higher African-American youth unemployment rates and so on. So they think that liberals, by proposing to raise the minimum wage, want to do good but are inadvertently doing harm. But when you look at how liberals talk about conservatives during those debates, they say you don't want to raise the minimum wage. You obviously don't care about poor people. You're trying to screw them. In other words, your intentions are not good. And that asymmetry, I think, matters. It implies that conservatives understand that liberals want to achieve common goals. They just don't have a very good strategy for getting there, whereas liberals often don't extend that assumption of good faith to their conservative interlocutors. And one of the things that made me think was that conservatives understood that liberals and conservatives disagreed about means. We disagreed about how to do things like beat poverty and raise employment and so on. Whereas liberals were not really giving credit to conservatives that they did have a theory of how the world worked. And they assumed that if you disagree with us on means, you must disagree with us on ends too. In other words, we know how the world works. And even you know that we know how the world works. So if you disagree with our policies, you must not want the same goals. And I think sometimes that phrasing even appears very explicitly in the article that you referred to. I quoted Paul Krugman and a few others as saying, in effect, conservatives know perfectly well that they're full of it. They know perfectly well that their prescriptions don't work. They know, in other words, that our prescriptions do work. So the question is, why do they pretend otherwise? And I just think that's a fascinatingly intellectually condescending thing to say. And the whole point of my op-ed was that I think liberals and progressives, maybe particularly intellectuals, have a habit that I'm not sure they're aware of. When they talk about conservatives, they often don't really give credit to the words, the actual sincere words coming out of conservatives' mouths. They hear those words and think, okay, what's really on their minds? And that's I think, exemplified in books like What's the Matter with Kansas, which says, look, these people think they care about social issues, but they're just being manipulated into saying that or thinking that. Or Barack Obama, frankly, I know it's a trite comment, but that comment of his during the 2008 campaign that people in Midwestern towns and manufacturing towns, they faced economic despair, and they responded with emphasis on guns and religion and trade and immigration. And all of those, I think a lot of progressives and liberals don't understand the effect of that kind of discourse. They're saying, oh yeah, I heard what the conservative said, but let me tell you what is really bothering them. And that is, I think, a form of intellectual condescension. It says that you think that you mean what you're saying, but you don't really. Here's what's really bothering you.
This is going to be our method throughout the hour is, you are the expert in the studio today. It's your article. I cannot, and I'm not well-versed enough to stand on the other side and make the arguments back. But I will have to play the role of both asking you the question so that you can speak your thoughts and the process as someone who needs to be taught a little, but also has some questions that I don't understand that you need to explain to me. And so you ask about the conservative side having their information, but we liberals misunderstand what your means are, or misunderstand what your goals are. Don't I know what your goals are because of the activities that have taken place? And you mentioned right away about minimum wage and dropping or keeping minimum wage lower at $5 plus an hour versus $7 plus an hour. But the cost for housing only goes up. On a yearly basis, the cost for housing only goes up, whether or not the person is employed at $5 an hour or employed at $7 an hour. Is that correct?
Until the last couple of years, yeah. And needless to say, I can tell you right now, even though I'm not an economist, I can tell you what a free market economist would say, would respond to you. Yours is a legitimate concern about the cost of living. Think how much harder it is for a person who's been priced out of the market by a higher minimum wage to pay that housing cost than someone who's still working. Right.
Granted, I mean, that's certainly, and I can't argue with that. But what we have seems to me to be, it's the other side of the fence that isn't being clearly, we're talking about this not from scientific data.
Right.
The information that you present in the two articles talks about how the liberals always talk about they know what the Republicans really mean. But there's no scientific data presented with that. And so isn't this what you and other columnists, isn't this what your columns do as well?
Well, I don't write a lot of columns.
But these two, and that's what we're on for today, is that we're going to get some people fired up, I have no doubt. As I said, I had people like raising their shoulders.
Yeah.
As soon as I said what the topics were.
Well, take, for example, my article about the second one, about debates over race, and above all, about conservative racism. My description there of what a lot of liberal and progressive views about conservatives are, that's not just anecdotal. It's not just from listening in the faculty lounge on one campus. That's part of a significant research project I'm working on, and that's from reading many dozens, if not hundreds, of scholarly books and articles and journalistic books about modern conservative politics. And one of the major veins running through those books is a certain narrative about the role that race and racial attitudes have played in the rise of modern conservatism. So I may not be presenting you with survey data about what liberals believe, but I am able to relate to you and summarize what many dozens, if not hundreds, of books and articles written by scholars and journalists have said about conservatism. That I can describe fairly systematically, not anecdotally.
All right, let's jump into, rather than me battering back and forth with you, and let's give an opportunity for people to understand what is in the articles, and then we'll take calls in another 5-6 minutes or so after the first break. You talk that there are four beliefs that are out there that liberals have of conservatives that are incorrect. Is that proper?
I don't know about I guess I'm just enough of a creature of the postmodern era. I shy away from strong words like incorrect. I don't doubt that each of them has some basis in reality, but they are the narratives that I described. I think they're important and they are very pervasive in a lot of liberal conversations and progressive conversations about modern conservatives, because
and this is a problem that I regularly have with a professor.
We talk too much.
No. Because that's what we're doing for the hour, is that not all of us who are listening are in the class. So we haven't had 101 and 102, et cetera. So when you say narrative, choose simpler words or explain that a little bit as you go along. Because what you write is that there are four descriptions, four beliefs, whether they are correct or incorrect. Is that true?
Yeah.
Is that a better word choice?
That's a perfectly fine word choice.
Okay.
All I meant by narratives is we have stories in our heads that tell us about the politics we face and about a lot of other things in life, too, for that matter. So that, for example, to this day, I think when we think about the rise of Nazism, we all think about the Great Depression. We think that that played some crucial role. When we think about the rise of Islamist insurgencies against the United States, for example, in Afghanistan or Iraq, we tell a story in our minds about resentment at a foreign occupier. We assume that it has some basis in religious beliefs or a particular strand of them. And that's all I meant by narratives, that when liberals and progressives think about the conservatives in their midst, and especially the rise of conservatives from relative obscurity in the 1930s, 40s, 50s to the positions of preeminence in the 1980s and ever since, there are different stories and descriptions, as you say, that people have about where this came from and what caused that to happen. And
so it's not a picture in my head, it's a story in my head.
I think that's right, because it involves individual historical figures and it involves stories like economic despair may lead to this. And what I was doing in that article was listing four, I think they're not the only four stories that people have, liberals and progressives, about where conservatives came from and what motivate them and what caused them to be and say what they are. But what's important about those four, which are very pervasive, it seems to me, very common ones about conservatives, is that they all have in common that they assume that something gave rise to conservatives and motivated them other than what conservatives themselves say they care about. And so one of them, for example, is the one about race, that conservatism was born out of racial bigotry, but that's not what conservatives will say if you ask them. They talk about things like, we don't like crime or we find the burdens of taxation too heavy, but what's really going on is race. And that's just one example. But there are several others. I can't believe I'm saying this. I'm nervous being on the radio, but I can't even remember all four. If you prompt me, I'll tell you chapter and verse, but you'd have to list them for me. But in this case, what they all have in common, as I say, is that they all assume that the words coming out of conservatives' mouths shouldn't be taken overly seriously because something else, something deeper, is really motivating them.
All right, we are talking with Professor Gerard Alexander, UVA's Department of Politics. Two articles written in 2010 for the Washington Post. Conservatism does not equal racism. Why are liberals so condescending? His two articles. We will be taking calls in another 3 or 4 minutes. Sean McCord here today to take your call. Please be polite to Sean. All right, so we are talking about the first article, Why Are Liberals So Condescending? Four stories in the head that go with someone when a liberal is speaking about someone who is conservative. Vast right-wing conspiracy.
That this was organized, that the politics we see outside our windows when we look at conservatives, that this is something ginned up and brought into being by elite actors who want to whip these people up for their own purposes. That's a theme of Thomas Frank's huge best-selling book, What's the Matter with Kansas? And lest we think that was just sort of a one-time thing, that's a very common image, that Fox News is somehow the cause of all of this. It's the way that the Koch brothers, that David and Charles Koch, are being discussed now, that somehow Tea Party activism can be explained in terms of them throwing a few bucks around and ginning up an astroturf, not a true grassroots kind of political movement. And I think what all of that kind of language and those kinds of stories have in common, it says that the people who actually show up at rallies, the grassroots activists that make up any large political movement, progressive or conservative, that somehow they're just being manipulated, that they're under a kind of false consciousness. And I think that's obviously intellectually condescending. It's implying that you really don't have to take seriously what they're doing and saying, that the Tea Partiers are out there because someone has more or less either manipulated or cajoled or paid them or some combination of the three to be where they are, as opposed to saying, look, this is millions of people. It almost certainly represents some kind of sincere indigenous set of concerns on their part, and we should be talking about that. And I think the incredible ink that's been spilled on the Koch brothers is a great example of how distracting from a healthy conversation it is to just assume that this is a conspiracy from above.
And one of the reasons to me that the difficulty of having bipartisan politics is, you know, I read your articles and I found them quite interesting. But doesn't it work the other way? When Jon Stewart goes to Washington, D.C. to have his event to try and get people, I can't remember what, Sean, didn't you go?
Rally to Restore Sanity.
He was put down by those who on the conservative side of the fence for working people up. I mean, it's effectively, to me, it's what you just said about those, what the liberals say about those on the other side.
As I say in the article, there are voices on both sides of these debates that say that the other side are idiots, that they're intellectually inferior, that they believe what they believe because they're dupes or stupid. That such voices absolutely exist on both sides, and we could list conservatives saying it just as well. I just do not find on the conservative side of the political spectrum, and I read a lot of conservative media, I do not find regular discourses, languages, that explain that liberals and progressives don't really believe what they're saying. They really believe some other thing, and that they're in effect under a kind of false consciousness. So I can list a book like Thomas Frank's or a slew of others, or I can cite Barack Obama's comment about clinging to guns and religion. But I really do, when I'm told, isn't this just as common on the other side? You tell me a best-selling book among conservatives, or much less 10 or 15, which would be easy to find among liberals, that says that liberals and progressives believe what they believe only in a false consciousness sense, that they don't really believe what they're saying, that they don't sincerely believe what they're saying, and that they're really motivated by some other less obvious motivation, like economic despair or manipulation by elites. And I just don't see a lot of that. That I can find straight comments, I don't doubt that for a second.
But, and I'm not willing to do that. I didn't do my homework because the goal was not for me to argue with you for the whole hour. The goal is to give you the opportunity to state your articles and the topics to go with it, and for me to ask the stupid guy at the on the corner question, and then have some people call in.
Let me just say two quick things. The most common response I got from liberals and progressives who thought that I was not being even-handed was not to say that conservatives also claim that liberals are dupes or under false consciousness. The most common was that don't conservatives generate a different narrative, which is that a different accusation, which is that liberals and progressives aren't patriotic. And I think that has more, that bites, that has more teeth. Because there the accusation, notice, is not one of liberal condescension, but if you will, of patriotic condescension. I love my country more than you do. To the point where among liberals and progressive friends of mine, we regularly joke about this, and I'll say to them, look, I know you don't really love your country, but if you were to, right? And they'll crack up because they know that's part of the conversational ether. And let me just add one last comment before your listeners are polite to Sean, but have at me, which is to say that this was not my jumping into this conversation about our national conversation wasn't designed as a nah, you're screwed up too, a contribution. It was meant to say, look, I think that liberals and conservatives, most of the time they debate, are debating about how do we best achieve goals that are common to both of us. We both want more growth. We both want a better quality of life. We both want lower crime. We both want children to get better educations. We both want, and so on and so forth. And I think the problem is that there is a larger number of liberals and progressives who don't, they're at heart not really convinced that conservatives want those things. And what my articles really were meant to be was an appeal to say, look, we would be having a healthier national conversation if we both acknowledge that we both want most of the same things. What we're robustly disagreeing on, and that is very vigorous, and we should be disagreeing about, is which policies actually work to get us there.
Yeah, but when you put that title on there, I think you turn
off. I keep telling you.
I understand that. But when you allow it, or when someone from the the editor puts that title on the article, then I think that washes away any opportunity for that. 11:23 here on the Wake Up Call. Our weather for today, markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley, mostly sunny with the chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon. Today, high is 85, with a little cooler over in the valley. Mostly cloudy with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms in the evening. Tonight, lows 55 to 60, warmer in Richmond. And then mostly sunny with a chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon. Tomorrow, highs in the upper 80s. Right now, it's a pretty nice day out there, but humid. 73 in the valley, 75 in Lynchburg, 79 in Richmond, 76 in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And let's thank Dixon Disposal for their support. Dixon reminds you that you can reduce household garbage by purchasing products with reuse and recycling in mind. Small changes in your lifestyle can keep our planet green for years to come. When Dixon's picks up your trash, they sort and separate it for recycling. You can help the planet stay green with curbside service from Dixon Disposal at your home or business. More can be found at 978-2111, online at DixonDisposal.com. Let's also thank The Backyard, the university's culinary secret at the end of Elliewood Avenue. The Backyard has a new spring menu with daily specials and an ever-changing list of beers on tap. Their outdoor patio is now open for lunch and dinner. For more info, dial them up, 202-8215. Find them on Facebook, online. It's TheBackyardUVA.com. All right, we're back with our guest today, Professor Gerard Alexander, from the University of Virginia's Department of Politics. Two highly wound-up articles when you put the titles on there by that darn editor. Conservatism does not equal racism. Why are liberals so condescending? You know, we were talking about the title and the information that's sort of listed in there. Liberals pronounce conservatives to be ideological. I think I found that phrase somewhere in one of these articles. Liberals pronounce conservatives to be ideological. Is that worse than calling liberals condescending?
It's striking to me that I would have written that sentence. I mean, I know it's been a little while, but the fact is most politically active and commentator types do find the other side to be ideological. That's something it seems to me it's... that's just tit for tat in American politics and probably politics everywhere in the world. So I'm not sure quite. I'd have to look at the context of where I wrote those words. But you're implying to me, if I understand you right, that by pointing out that liberals and progressives may have been doing something that they didn't even realize in their discourse about conservatives, that might have invited a national conversation about that. But by giving it a title and that's pugilistic and by making it somewhat accusatory, well, that washes that away. And I can't believe you mean, all right, sorry, we could have had an interesting conversation about that, but now just having been accusatory, the hell with that.
Well, what I think is that it starts things on the, instead of starting it, the conversation on the basis of, you know, you mentioned earlier talking with your friends and sort of joking about the, your lack of patriotism. And I think you can do that because you start that on a, you know that to be a joke, but the conversation starts on a friendly manner.
Okay.
And we'll open the phone lines now, 979-0919 and 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. That's 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. I saw the phones ringing earlier. But I think when you start someone with that sort of, and you've said pugilistic several times, whether it's you or the editor, when it starts in a pugilistic manner, to me, that means you're swinging. You come out swinging. So that means that the other side needs to swing back. And so you're fighting before you can even talk.
All right. Well, I guess the standard way to start this conversation in a more joking manner is to say, look, I know that as a conservative, you may not think I'm too bright, but I think I've noticed, now even that got a smile out of you, right, that I may not be too bright, but I think I've noticed that there's a kind of liberal condescension towards conservatives, and I don't think it's helpful. I think it's often inadvertent, I think it is often unaware, and I think it's not helpful. And
that's not going to make me pick up the newspaper, though.
Well, I hate to say this, but that editor who you think I'm accusing, on the contrary, I have a certain admiration for him doing his craft. I'll say about him what my father always said about McDonald's. They're good at what they do. And he knew a story that would get a lot of attention and legs, and he had a much better instinct for that than I do. There's a reason why I'm a college professor, and he's the editor of a major section of one of the most important newspapers in the country.
All right, we got our first call. Well, that's not quite fair. We got the first call that we let through. Todd, are you with us?
I am.
All right, Todd from Crozet, fire away.
Probably be surprised, being the first one out of the gates here, a registered independent, proud moderate, college educated, grew up in the Bible Belt, moved up here about 10 years ago. With all that said, my point is this whole so many issues in politics and all this judgment on both sides. The great thing is I sit around and I run into diehard liberals who tell you they're liberal, Republican diehard, that type, and people can talk and get along fine and they're happy in their life and got a good job and things are going okay. Yeah, they may be a diehard Republican, Fox News type, but they end up being moderate. No matter what you do, you're going to have this fringe on both sides, and I've seen them at the dinner table. I've listened to them. I've heard them carrying on about the other side, accusatory, so forth. My view on politics, religion, is separation of state. I wish there was a balanced budget amendment. I wish they had less money to talk about, spent less time up there talking about it, and just, I mean, the government is just, it's out of control monetarily. Anybody can figure that out. Anyway, all that said, I don't want to take up a lot of air time, but maybe you get my view, my gist.
Hey, man, Todd, thanks for calling.
Todd's, if I understood Todd's basic point, it was that a lot of average Americans are actually able to have conversations across this divide, whatever they believe, about politics, their own, and even if they sometimes have very critical attitudes about people who disagree with them politically. And I think that's right. I think the fact is, and this has been thought for many years and supported by many studies, is that politically active people tend to be somewhat more doctrinaire and more polarized than average citizens. And that's true in most countries, possibly all countries. And that's certainly true of our age today, where the fact is, in a lot of middle America, people, and here I'm not talking about geographic, but just outside of political elites and activists, a lot more conversing takes place across the political aisles. A lot more gets done across political aisles and commentators would suspect. And I think that's a healthy reminder for us. It's a healthy control. And I would hate to see the degree of polarization and pugilism that is existent among political activists and full-time political junkies to be disseminated to the whole population. I think that would be a terrible development.
11:31 on the Wake Up Call. Phone lines are open. Our guest today, Professor Gerard Alexander, UVA's Department of Politics. We are talking about politics, bipartisan politics. Are they even possible anymore? Two opinion pieces that Professor Alexander wrote in the last year. Why are liberals so condescending? Conservatism does not equal racism. We need to get at the racism article in just a moment. Let me thank Sugarsnap for allowing us to be on air. They offer gently used baby and kids items, including shoes and hats, maternity and nursing clothes. You'll also find cloth diapers and nursery gear and some locally made items. They have a kid-friendly play area, and you can become a fan of Sugarsnap on Facebook or Twitter. All right, Professor Alexander, we were talking about the liberals are so condescending article, and we didn't really get through the entire four narratives, the sort of stories in your head that a liberal would have when talking about the beliefs of a someone who's a conservative. Republican mobilization of ethnic and racial sentiments. Explain that a little bit.
Well,
I mean, because that seems to carry us to the next article.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's and I think the next article was an outgrowth of this one in that sense. And in this, it seems to me, is also a very common story. It's different from the article that people are just manipulated by conservative political elites into doing what they do, but rather that there are some genuine beliefs on the part of conservatives as independent, as average voters and activists and members of a, you know, broad political movement since the 1950s, and that, but that the beliefs that they voiced are in fact bigotry, that they're people who are, simply feel threatened by economic changes, they feel threatened by changes in America's racial relations, gender relations, and so on, and that one of the forms that their politics takes in response to that is conservative emphasis on everything from you know, limiting government spending to opposing busing or any opposing affirmative action. And that what's really going on in that politics is that conservatives have found ways to appeal to bigoted opinions on the part of white Americans, maybe especially white American males, but white Americans in general. And that that explains why so many conservatives have come out of the woodwork, including ones who in the 1930s and 40s were content to be liberals as long as that liberalism was white. And that therefore we should understand the politics ever since as being about a white backlash against the ethnic diversification and the rise in prominence and status of African Americans who'd been here all along.
Are there any correct negative beliefs of conservatives?
Oh, sure. For one thing, I don't deny for a moment that a huge number of people who voted for George Wallace ended up voting for Ronald Reagan, for example, much less Richard Nixon. We know that to be the case. The question is that the only way we should understand, for instance, the South 50 years later or 40 years later? And I think there, I can point you to a huge slew of books and articles and other arguments that basically treat the South, white Southern political behavior even now as kind of unreconstructed Wallaceism. And I just don't find that very credible. I don't find that very helpful. So, but are there racists? Of course. Are there anti-Semites among liberals and progressives? Yeah, unfortunately so. We're a big mosaic of a country, and it absolutely includes fringes and unfortunate things. Do I think there have been Republican policy initiatives that had more to do with corporate sponsorship, so to speak, and political donations? You know, I read the paper too. I get that. The question is that the sum and substance of modern conservatism? And I think that's the mistake analytically we sometimes make. And here's the parallel I would make. When FDR was in office and creating the New Deal as we came to know it, that was 20th century American liberalism at its heights, electorally, legislatively, and ideologically, in the sense of a confident belief system that helped guide public policy. That was also an FDR that cut a lot of deals with the Southern Democrats, who controlled a lot of congressional committees, and riddled through programs like Social Security in their early years were some accommodations to those segregationists. And there's no doubt about it. Do we allow that really to impugn our conception of modern liberalism and of the New Deal and of Social Security? Absolutely not. And so I think it's about as fair to say there are despicable characters in the history of modern conservative politics, and therefore we draw the conclusion from that all conservatives should be seen through those lenses. I just don't think that's historically very helpful, very accurate.
But are there specific beliefs? Because what we have listed in your articles, and the phone's ringing now, are beliefs that the liberals have that are incorrect or whatever word choice is best used.
I would say they're enormously exaggerated,
okay,
is the way I would put it.
So
I'm not saying that there aren't specific facts we could point to that are consistent with those stories. There are.
And that's fine. But there are liberal beliefs that are exaggerated of the Republican Party and the conservatives. And so my question is, what works the other way? What exaggerated misbeliefs are there on the conservative side about the liberals?
Oh, God, that would be easy to fill in. I suppose the single most famous, and I'm trying to think whether this is really sustained over the decades or was really sort of limited to the 50s and 60s, I think it still continues, is that there has been a tendency among conservatives to extrapolate when liberals and progressives have proposed doing X that moves, let's say, us towards government doing more of something, let's say whether it's in healthcare or 1,000 other things. There have been any number of conservatives very happy to extrapolate that to some future and extent of government takeover that the liberal advocates never intended, weren't advocating, and that describes a kind of socialistic future. And that's why I think so many conservative intellectuals have been prone to saying, you know, ask when a liberal asks for a mile, they're really asking for everything, that there's a socialistic agenda. And I think that discourse absolutely survives into the Obama presidency, that what pretends to be a social Democrat really wants to do more than that. And I could drown you in conservative commentaries which say Obama and the current Democrats in office say that they only want to do X when it comes to healthcare. They don't want to really take it over. They just want to regulate it a bit more. But they're only saying that because that's a political reality. They can't go any further. If they could, they would love to, right? And that's a kind of discourse in which behind every liberal lies a socialist, is believed to lie a socialist. Notice that's not about false consciousness. That assumes Obama does know what he wants to do. He's just being very cagey about expressing himself about things that would kill him politically if he said them out loud. So it's not intellectually condescending, but it is absolutely accusatory. And I suspect that 99 times out of 100, over the last 50 years, when conservatives have said that about liberals, it's been incorrect.
Let's take a call from Tom. Tom, are you with me?
Yeah.
All right, we got Tom from Charlottesville. Fire away, my man.
Yeah, I guess I'm an independent who sort of leans a little bit more to the right than the left, and I've felt like there's some sort of liberal condescension as well. And one thing I've noticed in that regard is that to me it seems like there's a lot more liberal bumper stickers, liberal T-shirts, things of that nature than there are for conservatives. And I wonder if it's can partly be because of socioeconomic stereotypes that go with those things that, you know, rich people are Republicans and don't want to put bumper stickers on their cars, but it could also be because liberals are more comfortable wearing their political views on their cars and T-shirts. The other question that I have is what the commentator thinks the role of conservative newscasters has played in this, and by that I mean, to me it seems that the mainstream Republican news channel Fox News is pretty condescending at times to liberals, whereas I don't get the impression that, well, maybe I should take that back. There are certain liberal news channels that are pretty condescending towards Republicans too, but maybe something like Fox News creates the feeling in liberals that they need to be more outspoken about their views. And the last thing I'll say is that, you know, I've always felt that NPR is perhaps, at least on the radio, the most neutral news channel that I could listen to. That said, I still have always felt like NPR leans to the left, noticeably so. So maybe, I don't know, I'd like to hear comments on that as well. And I will get off the air. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Tom. Professor Alexander?
Thank you, Tom. I'm tempted to to disagree with you a little bit about one thing. You said that Fox News and other media are condescending about people they disagree with. I would certainly agree that a lot of more opinionated news broadcasts are sneering about who they disagree with, that they're very condemnatory.
Is that better?
Well, to say, I really disagree with you and you're a jerk, or you're really wrong and you're harming something, might be a very powerful and important thing. Whereas to say, I'm actually not going to engage with the words coming out of your mouth because I don't even believe that you mean what you're saying.
They're just two different ways of dealing with the conversation.
Absolutely. And I wasn't trying in an op-ed to have a theory of the world. All I was doing was saying conservatives for decades have suggested that liberals are intellectually condescending. I'm hardly the first to say this. And I suspect that if I'd asked most liberal intellectuals, what do conservatives mean by that? What is it they're referring to? I think a lot of liberal and progressive intellectuals would have said, I'm not really sure. And what this article was doing was saying, here's, I think, what a lot of conservatives mean when they feel that way. And of the 1,000 or 1,100 emails I got personally after publishing it, I would say about half were from liberals saying, disagreeing with the line of argument, and conservatives saying, I can't tell you how many of the emails from conservatives said something to the effect of, I've been thinking this for years, thank you for actually saying it. And I think that's all I've been trying to contribute here, is inviting liberals and progressives to reflect that narratives, stories, languages they've developed about conservatives have often a funny element in which they're saying, I don't take seriously the words coming out of your mouth. I think something else is really motivating you. And I think it's an incredibly frustrating thing to be told. It's like everyone's treating you the way a psychiatrist would. They listen to your words and say, it's very interesting. Let me tell you what you're really saying, right? It can be a very frustrating thing, even if, mind you, psychiatrists are sometimes right, obviously, right? That said, I was trying to say that we would be having a more fruitful national conversation if we assume that the person on the other side of the aisle actually is motivated by the things they say they're motivated by, and that the proposals they're making should be taken seriously, even if only to say, here's why I think that policy wouldn't work. But rather than trying to go above it and having what amounts to a psychiatric conversation with your correspondent.
All right, we got another call on, but Tom, hang on just a second. It's time for me to do a little business here.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
8 months after a suicide rocked Virginia Quarterly Review's sparking allegations of workplace bullying, the magazine is back in mailboxes and winning awards with only one employee, the controversial Ted Genways. There's new pizza to be found in Barracks Road Shopping Center.
and relatives fear for a missing Fluvanna man. Change the way you read. Read the hook. And today's programming also brought to you by and support of Blue Ridge Graphics at Meade Avenue and East High Street in Charlottesville, providing custom t-shirts and sportswear plus promotional items for schools, organizations, and businesses. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746. Online, it's brgtshirts.com. And in just about 20 minutes, Drew Thompson will be here for Les Temps Perdue at noon, best of 80s and 90s alternative with Urge Overkill, Mighty Lemon Drops, and Eurythmics, brought to you in part by Orzo and the Visualite. Requests are always welcome on Les Temps Perdue. All right, our guest today, Professor Gerard Alexander from Department of Politics. Two exciting opinion pieces, Conservatism Does Not Equal Racism, and the other, Why Are Liberals So Condescending? Let's take our call from Tom. Oh, actually, this one's from Kyle. Hey, Kyle.
How you doing?
Hey, we're well. Question or comment for the professor?
Well, probably a question first and a comment. My first question would be to both of you. What would you like to see the media, the role media should play in today's political environment? Because right now, I just see the media, they only ever report on how bad things are or how polarized every subject seems to be getting, instead of presenting, you know, everyone's solution to said problems. And how should we as the people perceive the media as opposed to just take in all the crap that's being, you know, put out there these days?
Professor, jump in.
I haven't really thought about whether the media generally report negative news. I know that it's famous they cover crime and obviously wars and other things, but it's also, I believe, been shown in studies that media tend to cover stories about poverty less often than they might otherwise or that might be warranted, because a lot of viewers just find it depressing and don't want to hear about it or think about it. So I think it may be a mixed bag. What I would say is, we've relied on media for decades to basically bring us information, and we like to think of the media as bringing us the information we need to be responsible citizens and responsible adults and parents and lots of other things. And there's been a certain lamenting of how much opinion has cropped up in media in recent decades.
And I do see a lot of opinionated talk shows that present their opinions as fact, as opposed to, you know, I think this is what I think, as opposed to this is what it is.
Yeah, I do suspect that's here to stay, at least for a good while. There seems to be too much, frankly, you may not like it, but boy, a lot of people do. And I must admit,
I have great respect for anyone who has, you know, a strong opinion. There's no problem with that. It's just, I would prefer to have, you know, someone speak to me in a civil tone, you know, about their opinions on a subject and bring up ideas, as opposed to saying, oh, you know, I consider myself a liberal, and a lot of the things I get are, oh, Obama is a socialist and a Nazi. And I know I hear that on Fox News too, but I hear it from, you know, people I talk to every day, and I just hear that and I immediately, you know, kind of switched on in my head, oh, they're, you know, a Republican, you know, or I don't want to say they're crazy. But it just seems like that people will, you know, take in anything these days as fact, and it just seems irresponsible on the part of those who are just putting anything out there to, you know, stir up controversy or, you know, polarize the left and right, as opposed to actually trying to solve a problem.
Hey, thanks, Kyle. I appreciate the call. That's some pretty interesting stuff.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Professor, we are talking with Professor Gerard Alexander from UVA's Department of Politics. There is time left, 11:48. You're welcome to call up with your question or comment, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. One of the questions from reading the articles that came out is, Democrats and liberals claim to have a PR challenge due to conservative misinformation. Explain that to me a little bit.
Well, I think that one of the mistakes that any political party, political movement can make is that when they're unpopular, to simply attribute that to to image and reputation and not concern themselves with substance. And that's happened to all kinds of political movements. It's very common among incumbent presidents when they don't do well in the polls that we just have to sell ourselves better. And that's something that affects Republicans and Democrats alike. But I think, for example, one of the things that is, I think, awfully short-sighted about, I'll just pick one current example of liberals and progressives who focused a lot of attention on liberal websites and commentators on the Koch brothers and Koch industries and blaming them in effect for the surge of Tea Party and other kind of conservative politics at the moment. It's just, it may be congenial to say we would be doing fine if it weren't for these two villains or a few villains like them, but I think that's just off base. I mean, it's just, I don't think that's reality. If the Koch brothers disappeared tomorrow, you'd still have several million Tea Partiers who felt much the same way and did much the same thing. And it's just not very politically effective, I don't think, to just say, look, we've got a PR problem. We've got to invent better slogans. We need better bumper stickers. We need to put our things in sound bites. I have heard in my lifetime liberals say, the reason conservatives are winning right now is because their ideas can be put into sound bites in an inherently easier way. Ours are more complicated. Now, I have absolutely heard conservatives say, at moments of liberal triumph, the problem of ours is that, you know, our ideas are, they're less this, or they're more complicated, or they're more whatever, and therefore those things can, you know, redistribution, I'll make someone else pay for your health care, that can be put on a bumper sticker, whereas conservatives' arguments about how markets really work, that can't be simplified as well, and darn it, if only we could figure out a way to communicate this. And political movements, therefore, of both sides, of all sides, have done that in my lifetime alone, and I find it eccentric. It's very congenial to think, hey, if you could just find a better salesperson, you'd be doing great. But I don't think that's the real world. The real world involves a lot of people making a lot of substantive calls about what they see. And I think those substantive concerns have to be addressed. And that makes for a much more serious conversation. And that doesn't mean bumper stickers don't matter. It just means bumper stickers can't possibly be represent real solutions.
Yeah, bumper stickers just get so dirty and fall apart. You can't really read them unless you get too close to the car behind
faded
you.
And
support today also coming from Ben Around Tattoos in Charlottesville and downtown Waynesboro. They feature male and female tattoo artists. They have thousands of designs available, and then they can create work from design that you provide as well. Ben Around Tattoos is in downtown Waynesboro in Charlottesville. They're at 701 West Main Street. Go online for more information, benaroundtattoos.com. All right, 11:51 on the Wake Up Call with our guest, Professor Gerard Alexander, as we talk about partisan politics, and a little bit about bipartisan politics. Is that even possible any longer? 979-0919-1877-WNRN-ROCKS. Professor, one of the things in the conservatism does not equal racism article, obviously, is that conservatists are not racists, right? They don't choose their decisions on crime and money, et cetera, because they want particular ethnic groups to do poorly. But conservatives run on strong legal backgrounds, correct? They want stronger jail system. They want stronger police groups, et cetera. But by doing so, doesn't that create a greater percentage, there are a greater percentage of African Americans in jail.
It's possible that conservatives have been, in some cases, less concerned about that because the people who disproportionately ended up in prison were not people that they identified with. Is entirely possible. My basic point is that while there no doubt have been conservatives who are racists, goes without saying, just as historically there were liberals and pro-New Dealers and lots of others who, you know, Woodrow Wilson and a million others, whose racial bona fides we came to question. The question is not that. The question is not have there been conservatives who are racist. The question is, should we understand most conservative positions and policy proposals as secretly or even only slightly secretly racial in their nature? And take the violent crime one. I think that's a great example. The assumption is that when law and order policies in the 1960s became a major staple of conservative policy proposals and campaigning, the assumption was that that lust, it seemed to some, to use force, to crack down, to sort of take tough approaches to crime was a basically a white expression of hostility to and fear about and almost a desire to use force against African Americans who were trying to achieve more in American society than they had been allowed to up until that point. I would only point out that while that's an entirely plausible argument, an entirely plausible interpretation of conservative views about crime, in the exact same decades, conservatives had also a, when you think about it, incredibly similar approach to predators abroad. That is to say, American national security policy in conservatives' minds was almost, it could be described in almost exactly the same terms. Domestically, like internationally, they believe that there are people who can be predatory and be bullies and be aggressors, or they can be deterred from doing so if you're robust enough in their face. That they, if they transgress, you have to deal with them in a muscular fashion and punish and make it more costly for them than it's worth. And they have the exact same arguments about international aggressors like the Soviet Union as or Saddam Hussein or Al-Qaeda as they do about domestic aggressors. Well, when you put it in that context, it would seem to me it's more plausible that conservatives are expressing a fairly consistent belief system about human nature, about what causes predation or bullying or transgression, violent transgression by actors, whether they're domestic pocket, you know, purse snatchers or international invaders like Saddam of another country. And therefore, we have two competing arguments here. Conservative crime policies are really about race, in which case we have no idea what causes their parallel views about international foreign policy, or we assume that conservative ideology is probably pretty consistent across these two things, and we can explain both. Well, as a social scientist, I'm kind of naturally drawn to the theory that can explain two significant parallel outcomes instead of just one.
All right, let's take a call. We have Ray, but I believe we were... Is there still a good connection? Hi, Ray.
Hi there.
All right, fire away.
My question was, I was actually reading some of the articles online, and I was wondering, I'm mostly a conservative myself, but one of the feelings in the conservative crowd is that we can understand and put ourselves in the shoes of liberals easily because we are exposed to liberal ideas all the time, and you have to choose to be a conservative as opposed to sort of a soft default in today's society of being a liberal, but that liberals cannot understand conservative positions, and that's where all the, well, because why do conservatives think what they do, because they're crazy or racist or whatever, is because liberals just cannot mentally comprehend conservative ideas because they're not exposed to it. And I was wondering if that was something you agreed with or could expound on.
It's a very interesting point. Look, as someone who is a conservative and some kind of intellectual and a full-time academic and living in the Northeast Quarter, even if on the southern fringes of it, I have for all of my life been exposed to the New York Times, you know, mainstream media sources, and tons of scholarly conversation and writings. I have an extensive experience with liberal and progressive points of view on a variety of things. And to this day, I read not only the New York Times and the Post, and but I subscribe to the New Republic. I periodically pick up the American Prospect and the Nation. I know very few liberal intellectuals and progressive intellectuals who subscribe to the National Review or regularly read the Weekly Standard or regularly look at the website of the Heritage Foundation. It's very asymmetric. That said, I don't know what the story would be if we were, let's say, in, I'm trying to think of the sort of stereotypical conservative state, and I might have to pick a southern one or a mountain western one, a Montana or an Idaho or a Mississippi. And there, would I find that conservatives had more experience to liberalism or liberals had more exposure to conservatism? I would not be surprised to find that the most fruitful conversations in America might be held between a conservative who lives in a mostly blue setting and a liberal who lives in a mostly red setting, because each of them have been forced by their context to engage a lot with the other side's point of view. Maybe not always in a friendly manner, maybe not without complaining, but they've been exposed to those arguments. They know a lot of people who hold them sincerely, and I think that's probably where a lot of fruitful conversation to take place. Some of the best political conversations I've ever had were with Democrats from places from Nebraska and Utah and other places, because both of us, given our lifestyles, if you want to call it that, have, you know, talked to so many good faith people with whom we disagree politically that we know that good faith is not the problem and that there's a lot to be learned across that aisle. So I take your point, but I wonder if it would apply equally across everywhere in the U.S.
Hey, man, thanks, Ray. Good stuff. All right, just a moment or two left on our conversation today, our bipartisan politics, even possible, Professor Gerard Alexander. Professor,
You know, we really haven't gotten into it much about the conservatism does not equal racism. Hasn't the conservative center moved further right? I mean, you wrote this article and everything seems to flow back from 1960 to 1990, but hasn't it moved further right in the year 2000 so that there may actually be a little racism? And I can sit here and I'll get 1,000 emails maybe, but it seems that the Republican Party has split a little bit, and so that there is a little bit more about conservatives wanting there to be the America of the 1600s or the 1700s where there weren't others in their way.
Again, that's something that's entirely possible. On the other hand, I'm going to tease you that in your devil's advocate role just now in that question, you're in effect saying, oh, come on. Doesn't there have to be some of that in there? And I just think that in the absence of really good evidence, there's a part of me that just doesn't understand the helpfulness of that charge. And I don't want to call it an accusation. That's even more accusatory. But to say that to disagree with Barack Obama is an expression that I don't want an African-American man in the White House, I just find incredibly eccentric. I don't think Barack Obama hatred is any stronger than Clinton hatred was or the George W. Bush hatred was.
Well, and I'm not saying that I would disagree with that.
Yeah. Do conservatives really want to turn the clock back? They certainly want to in terms of certain kinds of values, everything from sexual mores to, I don't know, lots of other things we could probably list. If you took a poll asking Americans, would the country be better off if a lot of minorities, you know, went back to their home countries? It's an interesting question, and I'm not positive what they would say. Talk about a great research.
Which is why
agenda.
You need to come on the program again
to do the survey, exactly.
Well, your next article I'll have you on is Why Conservatives Sneer at Liberal Jerks.
There you go.
I think we figured that out later on in the hour. All right, it is time. It's 12 o'clock. We didn't get anywhere near the conversation that we could have had. I hope you will come on again in the future and you drive down on a Sunday
from the
Washington, D.C. area. Thank you. Our man, Drew Thompson, is next with Les Temps Purdue.
This has been your Wake Up Call on WNRN. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@AOL.com or at wakeupcall@WNRN.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Sean McCord. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.